Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
When the government was passing around bailout money last fall like it was Halloween candy, nobody was quibbling over $1 billion here or $1 billion there. Pretty soon, though, it all does add up, and a report out today suggests we overpaid by a good deal to rescue AIG. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. Marketplace is distributed by American Public Media. For information about underwriting this or other APM programs such as The Splendid Table, visit AmericanPublicMedia.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Tuesday. It is the 17th of November. And the facts before us, ladies and gentlemen, are these. In the hustle and bustle of last fall, the federal government spent billions of dollars bailing out AIG. Some of those billions went straight to companies with whom AIG had made, in essence, side deals. A report out today from the TARP Inspector General Neil Barofsky says the government didn't do all it could to save taxpayers' money on those deals last fall. Facts, though, are nothing without a little bit of context, and for that we turn to our senior editor, Patty Hirsch. Hello, Patty.
How you doing?
I'm all right. Listen, do me a favor and take us back to those days and remind us what the beginning of this story is.
All right. I'll take you back to September 15th last year. That's when Lehman Brothers collapsed.
Yep.
The next day, AIG looks like it's about to go under, and the government steps out with a big fat $85 billion bailout. Essentially the same problem. It was a money problem. Lehman Brothers didn't have enough money to operate. It couldn't get enough money in the door. AIG didn't have enough money to pay out the door. It needed to pay people for these contracts that it had written, and it just didn't have the cash on hand.
These credit defaults swaps that we all heard so much about, right?
Exactly. These are the credit default swaps, this animal, this type of insurance contract that AIG had written. And because of the way that the contract was written, if certain things happened, like AIG's credit rating fell, or the underlying securities credit rating fell, or they fell in the market, AIG had to pony up more cash to the banks that had asked for the insurance. And it had to keep on paying that money out. And it looked like it just wasn't going to have enough money to be able to operate.
So what happened between the day of that bailout and then November-ish when the New York Federal Reserve gets heavily involved?
Well, you know, the New York Fed was involved from the very beginning there because it came up with that $85 billion. So essentially, Tim Geithner, who was then the head of the New York Fed, had to go out to the banks and sort of work out a deal. It had to say, look, the best thing that we can do in order to solve this for AIG is to buy all of the underlying securities. And so, you know, can you guys help us with that? You know, can you cut us a deal? Because, you know, we've got this huge systemic problem. Can you shave a little bit off the price there?
And
they said no.
And that is the point of Barofsky's report today, that the government just drove itself a bad, bad deal.
Yeah, he said that basically Geithner should have negotiated better with the banks that he was dealing with.
But help me out here. Geithner was the regulator for these banks, and this is Barofsky's point. Couldn't he have just gone to the banks and said, hey, I'm in charge here. You will do this?
He had a couple of options. The first thing he could have done is say, look, you know, if you guys don't play ball with us, we're just going to let AIG collapse and then you're going to lose all your money. But of course, he just bailed AIG out to the tune of $85 billion and everybody knew that wasn't going to happen. So that was moot. The second option that he could have taken was to say, look, I'm your regulator and unless you help me out and cut me a discount, I'm going to wave the big stick and I'm going to hurt you some way down the line. You're going to owe me and you're going to hurt if you don't help me out now. But of course, if he'd done that, we'd be sitting here in a post-mortem however many months later saying, ooh, abuse of power, ooh, yeah. A terrible thing.
Well, here we are now 14 months later doing a post-mortem. What does this report tell us then?
I think the report tells us actually that Barofsky feels quite sorry for Geithner. He kind of makes the point that all of Geithner's protestations about why he couldn't front up to the banks were actually pretty valid. And I think the one point that he does make quite lightly but quite significantly is that the Treasury and the Fed, when they first got involved in this problem, looked only at the private market for a solution. And then it turned out that the private market failed and they needed to go to the public market. And I'm hoping that what will happen is that they'll look at this situation in the future and they'll say, look, we need a solution for both sides. We can't just depend on the market. Sometimes the government's going to have to step in. And if that's the case, we need a template to make it happen properly.
And just to take it out a little bit wider for a second, this is part of that broader financial regulation restructuring, right? As Congress thinks about banks that are too big to fail and the whole regulatory oversight, this is all part of that.
It is indeed. And, you know, hopefully the people who are writing this legislation will, you know, take a good close look at the front end of Borofsky's report and draw the lessons from that. Because Geithner's problems with the banks and the criticisms that stem from that all stem from this first problem, that they went to the private market first and they didn't have a solution for a public solution.
Our senior editor, Patty Hirsch. Thanks, Patty.
It's a pleasure.
A couple of big retailers reported pleasantly surprising third quarter profits today. It is, however, the fourth quarter where a lot of stores make or break their yearly profits, and there is some unpleasantly surprising news on that front for you. More Americans say they are going to be paying cash, not credit, for their gifts this year. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith has more.
It's an American tradition, like Thanksgiving turkey, eggnog, and the Macy's Day Parade. The January credit card bill, when you come face-to-face with the tab for all that holiday cheer. Fewer Americans will be having that moment this year. The National Retail Federation reports more than two-thirds of shoppers plan to pay for their holiday purchases with cash or debit cards. That's up about 10% from last year.
You're keeping closer track of what you're spending.
That's Connie Gause from Grinnell, Iowa. She'll be buying gifts for her sister, mother, and teenage daughter. She's on a tight budget, and she says credit cards make it too easy to spend too much.
I don't want to go into debt any farther than I already am because I don't know what the future is going to bring.
Lynn Colley is a consumer psychology expert at the University of Oregon.
When you use a credit card, you're saying you're pretty optimistic about the future. I may not have the money right now, but better to enjoy the pleasures of life now and worry about paying for them later.
That caution is bad news for retailers. Shoppers with plastic tend to spend beyond their budgets. Kathy Granis is with the National Retail Federation.
We may not see as many impulsive buys. There might not be that extra sweater purchase, that they don't throw that $20 on their credit card.
It's not just impulse buys that will be off the shopping list. About 80% of consumers say they'll buy fewer gifts this holiday season. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Any day now, we are going to get the official total for what the Senate health care bill is going to cost. The Congressional Budget Office is crunching those numbers. All the bill's supporters can do until they get those totals is wait. Opponents, however, are having a field day, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Ganza reports from Washington.
The insurance industry is lobbying furiously against the Senate health care overhaul. Some health care analysts say insurers aren't just shooting arrows at the bill, they're rolling out rockets. Analyst Jerry Katz is with Kurt Salmon.
They are lobbying against the bill. They're not lobbying against provisions of the bill. They want to take the whole house down.
The Chamber of Commerce is taking a bulldozer to the bill. Yesterday, the Washington Post reported the chamber is hiring an economist to study the legislation. The goal, more ammunition to sink the bill. Uwe Reinhardt teaches economics at Princeton. He says if the chamber does its study, it will probably get the result it wants.
You can always get an economist with a PhD from a reputable university to give a scientific report that makes your case. So, yes, there will be such a study.
Even some of the Democrats' traditional allies are taking aim at the health care bill. Unions are upset about a proposed tax on high-end insurance plans, which many union members have. Maya McGinnis is president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, a government watchdog group.
They have been ringing every warning bell possible. You see them warning their members, using the media as an outlet. They're more organized than most groups, so they can be very persuasive and their voices can be heard on Capitol Hill.
One voice may be heard on Capitol Hill for several days straight. Some Republicans want to require the Senate clerk to read the health care bill out loud on the Senate floor. It's at least 1,000 pages. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, it was a long, slow climb out of negative territory. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Detroit Lions have one win and eight losses this year. Over the past two seasons, they are 1-24. Dismal as that is, though, the team's former home has suffered an even greater indignity.
You're watching the Auction Network.
34 years after taxpayers spent more than $55 million building the Pontiac Silverdome, city officials have sold the stadium to the highest bidder, as Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
how often do you get a chance to buy a stadium?
Thanks to the city of Pontiac, you have the opportunity to own this internationally noted structure, its contents, and the land surrounding it.
You might think an 80,000-seat sports arena is out of your league, but yesterday the Silver Dome sold for just over $500,000.
I'm still stunned.
Raymond Skip Sauer writes the Sports Economist blog. In today's dollars, he says that dome cost more than $200 million to build.
That's a lot of money to have gone into thin air.
Another bidder filed suit to stop the deal today, but Andrew Zimbalist, an economist at Smith College, says when the Lions moved to downtown Detroit, the city of Pontiac became the latest casualty in a sports arena arms race.
The tax laws, as they have existed, have encouraged cities to bid against each other.
And that's left Pontiac, a small, depressed city with a yawning budget gap, stuck spending $1.5 million a year on upkeep for a massive stadium no one wanted to use. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
It is possible in this day and age to stay in touch 24 hours a day, if you so choose. Or if you'd care to look at it another way, cell phones and laptops and BlackBerries have made it almost impossible to disconnect. Try as we might, it is just hard to ignore all those emails and text messages and phone calls. So it's no wonder a lot of us are overwhelmed. But Sally Herships may have found an answer.
Every night, my boyfriend brings his iPhone to bed and his BlackBerry. Did I mention the laptop?
It's 5:45, and my boyfriend's phone just rang.
It was somebody from work.
And you answered it?
I did.
This, to put it mildly, doesn't make me happy. I'm trying not to take it personally. My boyfriend is a journalist and a news junkie, and it's not like he needs an excuse to stay wired all the time. Connected is the new normal. That drives Jenny Rausch nuts. Rausch is a journalism professor in New York, and she's what you might call old school.
I've tried telling my friends, I don't text. I don't have a text plan. Every time you send me a text message, it costs me 15 cents.
It's not the money that gets Rausch. It's the expectations. She says people who are totally wired expect everyone else to be too. Rausch doesn't want to feel pressured to answer emails on Saturdays. She wants her time back.
Something has to go, and the thing that has to go is the digital media.
Rausch is planning to go all the way. Next year, she'll set the clock back to 1985.
There will be television.
But no DVR.
A landline.
But no cell phones.
Records.
There's a movement for people like Rausch. It's called slow media. Kind of like slow food, but without the food. Slowies write letters and, you know, talk to each other. Offline. They like to do one thing at a time. Nick Jones is a computer programmer who lives in North Carolina. He has a slow media group on Facebook. Jones gets the irony, but he knows the downside of multitasking.
Sometimes I would have the British Office. It would be like on mute and running, and then there's a song playing, and then there's me writing code. And it was just, you know, it was too much. It was like trying to drink from a fire hose. It just wasn't, it didn't work. Thanks, high-speed internet.
But what does work, especially at work? Can you really get away with slowing down? Tom Jackson, also known as Dr. Email, teaches information science in England. He says technology isn't the problem, it's the way we use it.
The majority of employees react to incoming email within 6 seconds. Now, most people have their email application set up to check for new email every 5 minutes.
Jackson says every time you're distracted by an email, it takes about a minute to get back to what you were doing. All that time adds up. The average employee spends almost 800 hours a year just reading email. That's not including recovery time. Eric Bradlow is a professor of interactive media at Wharton. He says even if we took technology away, we'd still have a problem.
So I'll go back to the old days. I'll walk around to the water cooler and I'll sit there chatting with people. I think people will replace one form of distraction with another.
Bradlow says certain types of people, like him and my boyfriend, want to be connected 24/7. And that can be a good thing for employers. Bradlow says people who spend a lot of time in social media tend to be high achievers. And Jenny Rausch, the journalism professor, and Nick Jones, the computer programmer, do want to stay connected. They're both blogging about their new approach to media, slowly. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Sally's been trying to slow down a bit herself. You can find a link to her blog on our website, marketplace.org. Coming up, the race to dominate the green economy.
They don't mind go head-to-head with anybody. They feel they can beat people. The Chinese enterprises, they say, we can do it faster, we can do it cheaper.
But first, let's do the numbers. Light volume made for a relatively tame day on Wall Street today. The Dow Industrials finished modestly higher, up just 30 points, a quarter of 1%, 10,437. The NASDAQ nudged up 5 points, a quarter percent, wrapped at 2203. The S&P 500 eked out a single point rise, a tenth of 1%, 1110 was the number. Commodity-related stocks were today's winners. Rising demand for metal put a 1% shine on Alcoa. Rebounding crude prices lifted ExxonMobil stock by 0.8%. An upbeat analyst outlook boosted Microsoft shares 2%. Walmart shares climbed nearly 1% today. That is, Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway raised its stake in the retail giant by 90% and now holds around $2 billion worth of Walmart stock. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. www.batteninstitute.org. Now you can take Marketplace with you wherever you go. Tap in marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest business news, decoders that explain financial terms, and updates on the economic crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on new home construction for the month of October. The Labor Department lets us know what urbanites are spending on goods and services. The Consumer Price Index is released for October. And House Energy and Commerce subcommittees discuss H1N1 vaccine production and distribution. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
We start our letters segment today with Phoenix, as in the University of. A couple of weeks ago, as a co-production with the investigative newsroom ProPublica, we aired a two-part series about for-profit universities like the U of P. In particular, allegations that some for-profit schools use high-pressure sales tactics to get their customers in the door, and then they deliver substandard educations that leave their customers deep in debt. Those stories were far and away the most commented upon offerings we've had in the past couple of weeks. Some letters were critical of the school, some were critical of us, and some were like this from Jason Mitchell of Las Vegas, Nevada.
I truly see the value of online educational opportunities, but the issue is, what is actually offered compared to what is promised, and at what cost? Ultimately, it's about not promising filet mignon and serving up a greasy burger at the filet price.
Dear Old Dad got a lot of letters, too. Commentator Gustavo Arellano told us about how his own pride wouldn't let his 58-year-old unemployed poppy take a job in the private sector. Vidal Zuniga from Sacramento, California, heard that and had to write. He says, don't be so quick to knock the service sector. It saved his parents when his dad was laid off.
He very proudly provided for his wife and himself as a janitor. He was able to provide medical benefits for him and his wife. He even earned retirement benefits.
On the theme of jobs, we had management consultant Charles Handy on the program last week. He said if you do find yourself out of a job, the best thing to do is catch the entrepreneurial spirit and make your own work. John Platt from Seattle, Washington, said he's been thinking the same thing for months now.
Despite its many uncertainties, the one sure thing about being self-employed is that you always know who's in charge and who's in charge of your destiny.
Finally this week, a group of people that is especially affected when the economy goes south, the mentally disabled. Right now, they're losing their jobs three times faster than the average worker. Our story explained how much harder it is for them to find jobs in the first place. And that prompted a letter of thanks from Nancy White right here in Los Angeles, where she is the mother of a 27-year-old woman with autism.
Once disabled young adults age out of the public school system, there are precious few resources available for them. They too need jobs and want to contribute meaningfully to their communities and families.
If you would like to contribute, or if you've got a comment or a question, write to us. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. President Obama spent 2 hours with his Chinese host in Beijing today. After meeting with President Hu Jintao, President Obama said the two countries have no choice but to work together on the big issues, everything from nuclear proliferation to the international economy to global warming. On that subject, by the way, global warming, Mr. Obama said he is still expecting some kind of agreement to come out of next month's UN climate change conference in Copenhagen. When that deal is finally done, there will be much financial green to be had as well. So this week, our series, The Climate Race, is taking a global tour of how different countries are investing in green technology right now. And China is a big one. It turns out solar panels and wind turbines, it produces more alternative energy than any other country, but it also produces more greenhouse gases than anybody else, largely because it can't seem to get away from burning coal. But China does see a green lining there, as well, as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
China is industrializing fast. In the span of a single generation, hundreds of millions of people have left the farm and moved into cities. They've bought cars and electric appliances. Ming Sung is with the international nonprofit Clean Air Task Force.
In the rural area, they don't have air conditioning, they don't have refrigerators or TVs. So they want to have electricity. Can we deny their comfort, that sort of things? The answer is no.
China has four times as many people as the United States. That's a lot of people demanding lots of energy. Has to come from somewhere.
China is not blessed with plenty of oil. So the only energy resource they do have within their own control is coal.
An elevator takes miners down to the coal face in Shanxi Province, the West Virginia of China. It's risky work. On the average day, 30 Chinese men contract black lung disease. 9 die in mine accidents. Yet coal is China's economic oxygen. Retired miner Yi Yuezhi.
Mining definitely benefits the country. Remember the year southern China had a big snowstorm and they lost power? Comrade Hu Jintao came here and said, don't rest, keep mining coal.
Freight trains ferry the coal across this vast country to power the factories that export iPhones and khaki pants to a store near you. But a further unintended export is carbon dioxide. Energy consultant Bill Senior.
In China, coal use accounts for 80% of the energy-related CO2 emissions. So without a solution for that, we don't have a solution for climate change.
So China is racing to develop renewable energy. Wind turbines are being installed here faster than any other country, and China's put a much-vaunted plug-in hybrid car on the market. But the point of all this innovation isn't just saving the planet. It's to reduce China's imports of fossil fuels. China buys half its oil from overseas and some of its coal. Thing is, it could take a generation to make alternative energy cheap and abundant. So for now, China has to keep burning coal. It just wants to do it more cleanly and efficiently. One promising avenue is called carbon capture and storage.
On a single power plant, it could reduce the emissions by up to 90%.
Debbie Stockwell in the UK's Department of Energy and Climate Change helps emerging economies develop clean technologies like carbon capture. How does it work? Well, if you think of a coal-fired power plant as a car, carbon capture, or CCS, is like taking the tailpipe and sticking it in the ground.
CCS is really the only technology around at the moment that has got the potential to significantly reduce emissions from the power generation sector.
China is developing its own version. About 40 miles outside Beijing, the Chinese company ENN puts coal through a chemical process, which captures carbon dioxide in a pipe, so it's not emitted. And then, Get this, the carbon is pumped into tanks of algae. We all remember plants absorb CO2, right? The algae reproduces, and believe it or not, the slimy stuff can then be sold. ENN's Wang Yang.
Algae can be crushed, and the oil can be turned into diesel, jet fuel quality, or it can be made into anti-aging cosmetic cream. The leftover algae can be an additive for animal feed.
Now, algae sludge is not a big seller right now. It's certainly not the whole answer to climate change. But Ming Sung at the Clean Air Task Force says the point is there's money to be made in the clean tech race, and Chinese companies are certainly keeping pace.
They don't mind go head-to-head with anybody. They feel they can beat people. The Chinese enterprises, they say, we can do it faster, we can do it cheaper.
Faster because China's authoritarian government can issue permits and regulations without industry lobbyists slowing things down, as they do in the U.S. Cheaper because of low wages. In fact, one Chinese company has already exported its carbon capture equipment to a power plant in Pennsylvania. China and exports. Energy consultant Bill Senior's heard that before.
If carbon capture and storage becomes a global market, China could well be the manufacturing hub for much of the equipment,
just as they're
manufacturing everything else that we use in our day-to-day lives.
Chinese jobs and patents could follow, too. And for Beijing, that's a key point. As one observer put it, China lagged way behind the West in the Industrial Revolution. It won't let that happen this time in the green energy revolution. In Shanxi, northern China, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
You can hear all the rest of the stories in our series, The Climate Race. The archives are on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, the pricing pressures of a recession is seen through a glass of soda. Costco and Coca-Cola are in a bit of a spat. Coke is trying to maintain its prices and its profit margins. Costco is trying to get customers and profits in the door by offering those customers lower prices. That is the classic struggle between manufacturers and retailers. This one, though, is unusually public. Costco said yesterday it is not going to restock its Coke products until Coke offers what it calls competitive pricing. A little macro 101 for you there as we end the broadcast. That's Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow gained 30 points, about 0.25%. The NASDAQ up 5 points, also 0.25%. The S&P 500 bumped up a bare point or 0.1%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Doug Krisner on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abeed. Coming up, by the way, on the Morning Report tomorrow, an early look at Ben Bernanke's bet noir. That would be inflation. And on this broadcast, day three of the climate race, how is America doing?
There's a real risk that the United States, which has led so many of the recent economic trends, such as information technology, could well be left behind in the race to move to a clean energy future.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.